I'm going to start off today's episode getting a bit vulnerable and being transparent that on the Women Taking the Lead podcast, I have not given a lot of time to the topic of pay equity. Part of it is because I'm typically not working with women around the areas of negotiating salary. That may come up when a client of mine is being offered a promotion, but typically I'm not dealing with the issue of disparities in pay. And what my guest is going to really underscore for us today is pay equity is not something that comes about because women have good negotiating skills. I know, shocker, because that's what we've been led to believe for a long time now. If only women would develop certain skills, there wouldn't be so much inequity. My guest, Emily Aries, is calling BS on that. Emily Aries is a speaker, podcaster, and author, and she's the founder and CEO of Bossed Up, an award-winning leadership development and career services company committed to closing the gender leadership gap. Emily has worked with leaders at Fortune 500 companies to support retention, diversity and inclusion, and human resource initiatives, and has been featured in media outlets including The Washington Post, CNN Money, BuzzFeed, and more. Her book, Bossed Up, serves as a practical roadmap for women who want to set themselves up for sustainable, long-term career success and step up as the boss in their lives. And in this episode, Emily and I are going to discuss current stats on pay inequities. It's not just a problem for women. Why developing negotiation skills is not solving the gender gap in pay. What has proven to be effective in closing pay gaps across genders, ages, races, and abilities, and what you can do on the individual, organizational, and legislative level to bring about pay equity once and for all. If you are new to the Women Taking the Lead podcast, hello and welcome. I'm Jody Flynn. I'm the CEO and founder of Women Taking the Lead, a leadership development company that works with organizations and boards to close the performance gap by attracting, developing, and successfully promoting more women into senior levels of leadership. I help organizations realize these benefits through coaching, consulting, leadership development programs, and keynotes. I am now the past president of the board for the Maine Women's Conference, and I have the privilege and joy to work with women leaders to hone the skills and the mindset that allow them to grow into and then thrive in senior leadership. My specialization is working with women who are still stabilizing after their last promotion and those who want to be ready for the next one. If we are not already connected on LinkedIn, please send me an invitation to connect. You can find me directly at linkedin.com/IN/Jody Flynn, or you can search on the platform for Jody Flynn. I'm very active on LinkedIn, so I should be at or near the top of the search results. Be sure to add a note to the invitation letting me know you're a listener of the podcast. I would love to connect with you and get to know you better. Welcome to the Women Taking the Lead podcast, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me, Jody. Glad to be here.
I am thrilled to have you here. I've been waiting very impatiently for this day so we could have this conversation, but it's perfect timing because it is Women's History Month. But before we dive into what we're going to talk about today, everyone kind of knows that you're a rock star out there in the world doing amazing things through your business, Bossed Up. But what do you have going on in your life when you're not at work?
Let's see. So some fun facts. I have a 2.5-year-old son named Max who lives up to his name. He is like a full speed toddler right now and is so much fun. My husband Brad and I play in a garage band. I play the drums and I sing. I love hiking and skiing, and living near the Rocky Mountains in Denver, Colorado is a dream come true.
That's what I imagine everyone doing who lives near the Rocky Mountains. They're hiking and skiing all year long, like between the two things. So yeah. That's amazing. Okay, exciting topic, although one that like sometimes breaks my heart, but also talking to someone like you gives me some hope. So we are here to talk about the gender wage disparity. So give us a little overview of what this is all about.
Sure. So for as long as social scientists have been measuring it, we know that average earnings for women, just looking at women who work full-time year-round, are significantly less than average earnings for full-time year-round working men. And when you control for things like different industries, different levels of seniority, we continue to see a lack of equal pay for equal work. So currently, the national averages on the gender wage gap as of 2023, because the 2024 data is still coming out, was that women are earning 16% less than men on average. In other words, we're earning about 84 cents on every dollar that a man makes. And that's depressing enough, but it doesn't really tell the full story, Jody. You really have to get a sense of the scope of the problem when you look at the intersectional data around women of color who earn significantly less than 84 cents on the dollar, depending on different subsets of women. And the most alarming statistic of all is the motherhood wage penalties. You know, mothers who work full-time year-round are paid on average 69 cents for every dollar that a father makes, or $18,000 less per year.
Oh my God. Yes. Because when you're talking about cents on a dollar, it sounds so minimal.
Yeah.
But right, let's expand it. Like we're talking thousands of dollars per year. And I really want to underscore per year, because this becomes a compound effect, because the less money you can put into savings or some vehicle where you would earn interest, you're now losing out on interest on the dollar. So then that it's not even just the wage gap. It's just an earning gap becomes even more enormous. And women have to work longer in order to retire.
Yeah.
And they live longer.
Yeah. The irony is that women tend to live longer than men. And the wage gap compounded over time equates to about $1 million in lost wages over the course of a lifetime. I don't know about you, Jody, but I have some ideas of what I could do with $1 million in retirement. And it's really scary when you think about the caregiving responsibilities that fall disproportionately on women's shoulders, the retirement gaps in terms of savings, and the impact that has in end of life, right? This should be your golden girl's years. And yet this is when we see the lifetime impact, the compounding impact of the wage gap really leaving women in the lurch.
Yeah. And generationally, right? Because it's when, because women are living longer, their children and grandchildren then have to make up the difference, right? Because their money runs out and who's going to foot the bill? Or they have to have their older relative living with them without support.
Right.
Whereas, okay, let's look at the flip side. Even if somebody was living longer and wanted to live with family, they would have earned enough money to help with housekeeping or help with daycare and things of that nature. So there's, it really has a ripple effect.
Absolutely. And whenever we compare women's earnings to men's earnings, I can sort of hear the shouting from the men's rights movement that gets a little agitated about this. And I want to just be really clear. We're not pitting women against men here, right? We're saying that people should be paid fairly, regardless of gender, and that equal pay for equal work is really what we're all about here. Men and boys have their own fair share of massive social and economic issues. Men were disproportionately negatively impacted by the 2008 recession. The advent of AI and auto driving, like robotic driving, what is it called? Automated driving? Why am I blanking on that, right?
You're not going to get the answer from me.
Self-driving cars, right? Those are going to wipe out truckers industry jobs that are disproportionately going to negatively impact men too, particularly blue collar men. So I hate how partisan an issue this becomes, because this really isn't about men versus women, liberals versus conservatives. Like, we're advocating for economic empowerment of working people when we're advocating for pay transparency and equal wages. So I just want to acknowledge that boys and men, they're not all right either. Ezra Klein came out last year, this time with a really interesting podcast episode featuring Richard Reeves, who has a book about this. And it's worth acknowledging, as a boy mom myself, like, I'm pretty concerned about the state of men and boys in this country, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about the gender wage gap and how it disproportionately negatively impacts women, especially on Women's History Month. Like, let's acknowledge that we deserve that airspace and that airtime.
Absolutely. I like that you put that qualifier. We are going to focus on women, and that is not to say that there aren't other issues going on out there. But I am particularly interested in how this impacts women, because especially when it comes to, you know, once this was really starting to get some press and we're really starting to talk about it, like, some ideas started coming out of, like, how do we solve this problem? We may have heard of some of them, but you have some interesting data on this, Emily.
Yeah. Well, I have more of a confession more than anything, which is when I started my business, Bossed Up, back in 2013, I was part of a zeitgeist that, frankly, you're probably a part of too, right? Mm-hmm. That got swept up in what I call the lean in wave of feminism, right? I launched Bossed Up the same month, actually, that Lean In came out. You were ahead of the game, Jody. You were a few years ahead of us. But this whole movement around Lean In, or Arianna Huffington's book, Thrive, How Women Can Thrive in the Workplace, or what's her name? Sally Krawcheck, the sort of Woman on Wall Street's version of Owning It, or more recently, Ladies Get Paid, or Financial Feminist. All of these books, all of these movements, all of these businesses, and I am very much complicit in this, we directed our attention to helping women fix this problem by fixing ourselves. Mm-hmm. We said, women, you've got to ask for it. Here's how to negotiate. And to be clear, I've held my fair share of negotiation trainings over the years. I've written a negotiation guide we have for free on our website, and I've been a part of this zeitgeist. And I just worry that we, in doing so, forgot our history. We forgot that every right, every freedom that women have ever fought for and won happened through collective organizing. Not this individualist approach, this very capitalist approach to, I got mine, here's how you can get yours. And I do worry, Jody, that, and I've had my own little feminist existential crisis in the past year that has led me to this, but I really do worry that that emphasis we've placed on the individual solutions has taken up so much of the oxygen in the room around feminism in the past decade, that we've actually started to see some of our most hardest fought rights stripped away systematically. We don't have to look further than the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade to know what it's like to, you know, say, here's how women can negotiate their salaries and get their bag and make their money and win the capitalist system that was never designed for us, but also, oops, we just lost our bodily autonomy while we were busy trying to make more money. And I not that those two things are necessarily mutually exclusive, but I do worry that in perpetuating this individualist approach, we've really forgotten that every right we've ever won, you know, the 1963 Equal Pay Act that we passed, the right to get a credit card or a mortgage without your dad or husband having to sign off on it. Like, the rights that women have fought for and won in the 1960s and 70s, that wasn't that long ago. And that took on a really different collective approach. So I'm trying to change the way that I'm talking about this equal pay issue, because I don't think it was us that ever needed to change what we were doing. I think we need to think about system change.
You have me thinking in so many different directions. Two things that I want to bring up is, well, I'll start from the first one. Yeah. I think part of it is research comes out, it points to one thing, and it's almost like we jump on it, we double down. So the research I'm talking about is it came out that women don't negotiate their salaries. Like when they're offered a job and they're said, we will pay you this, women tended to say, okay. And so everyone went, that's the problem.
Right.
There it is, that one thing. And I would say this is another thing we have gotten into. Let's say this, I noticed this really happening in the early aughts too, right? When blogging, internet went, you know, everyone had access to the internet, people were blogging. Mm-hmm. And what we were seeing was a lot of, what's the one thing I can do, you know, that will make a difference? What is the, like, we're almost looking at, you know, what's, what are the fewest things that we can consider or work on that will get me the farthest, the simplest, the most efficient? Okay. Yeah. Now there is a place for all of that. But what you and I kind of know is if you jump on one variable, you're probably going to miss the target, you know, because it's not that simple.
Right. And I think as problem solvers, as leaders, and especially as women who've experienced some success, we get really excited to say, this worked for me. Let me share this hack with the world. And what we fail to realize is that what works for me does not work for everyone, does not necessarily work for my mom, a nurse whose pay grades are very fixed, doesn't necessarily work for women of color who can't perhaps agitate and assert themselves in the same way that I can with white privilege behind me, right? So what we forget is that I'm trying to hopefully continue to provide simple, step-by-step, solution-oriented advice, but to do so with a strategic systems lens. And I can give you some examples because let me tell you, I'll just say this. A year ago, I was supposed to be planning Bossed Up's 10-year anniversary. Right. Because we launched in March of 2013. So last March, I was really compiling a lot of data. I was trying to measure all of the programs we've ever run and all the progress we've achieved, how much success our clients had experienced. But speaking of data, to your point, I was also picking my head up off the desk for the first time in a decade to say, what are our KPIs for closing the gender leadership gap and closing the gender wage gap? And I had to reconcile what we've been working on, Jody, with headlines like these. Women are now more likely to negotiate salaries than ever before, but still earn less than men. You know, the gender pay gap in the US has hardly budged in two decades. In 2002, it was 80 cents on the dollar. In 2022, it was 82 cents on the dollar. So you're right. Like, we're problem solving, solution oriented people. And the variables that we've been focusing on, I really fear were the wrong ones. Mm-hmm. And I fear that it's taken our attention away from what are the right solutions, which is a more collective approach. It can still be done in a step-by-step way.
Yes.
But it's just, it's truly like triggered a full-on existential crisis of like, what the hell have I been doing with my life? And like, am I part of the problem?
Like
feminism, you know what I mean?
I've had those moments too, right? Because there is this, there's research that is done and you're like, okay, this is working. And you know what? Yeah. And I want to say this, negotiating does work. So, you know, in many different scenarios. So it's not like that is not a solution. It is. It is a solution to a problem that requires, like you said, a multi-pronged systematic approach. And if we're only focusing on negotiating, then that's why we're going to say, why has the needle not moved? Well, it's anecdotally moved for some women, but the majority, no, especially in a patriarchal society that says you should be grateful.
Totally. And it's like, I think there's that monologue that America Ferrera has in the Barbie movie. And it's such a great sort of clip from the film. But one of them, one of the pieces that really stands out is, you know, you should earn money and you should get money and you should, like, you know, go for your money, but you shouldn't ever ask for money. There is still a taboo that impacts women, particularly around asking for more. And the fact of the matter is, if we just encourage women to ask for more and don't change the social repercussions that women face and women of color face and mothers face for asking for more. I mean, it's called the motherhood wage penalty, mm-hmm. right? There are financial penalties to choosing to have your first child that negatively impacts women's earnings and they never recover from it. It's like, that's a social problem. That's not a women's problem. That's a way that employers view mothers differently than fathers, because when men become fathers, they actually experience the fatherhood pay bonus. Their pay tends to
yes. go up.
And it's like, there are benefits to men who are fathers and make that clear on their resume. Let's say they have a reference to a PTO on their resume. They did this really interesting experiment where they had the same resume, same experience, same qualifications. Woman mentions the PTO briefly. Man mentions the PTO briefly. The woman hardly gets any interviews or callbacks. The men, when they mention the PTO, are more likely to get interviews than men who don't mention their PTO. That is how favorably employers view fathers and how negatively employers view mothers.
And you know, it's so interesting. I'm gonna like really talk about this a little bit more, because you know, the data is showing it's all perception.
Yeah.
It is not reality.
Right.
Because the perception is, if he's a dad, he needs this job.
Yep.
He's going to be more reliable. He's going to be more loyal. He's going to really be a company man.
Right.
Because
he
wants a dad.
To be a provider.
Right. And okay, the reality is he is more likely to job hop.
Yeah,
looking for higher salaries, whereas women are more likely to be loyal. Now, there are pros and cons to both of these, right? So it's wildly interesting that there is this perception, like if a woman is a mom, she's going to be less reliable, you know, less likely to stay.
Yeah.
And a man, like, but a man would. And what we're finding is the reality is the opposite.
Totally. I think anyone who actually works with a mom or knows a mom or is a mom knows, like, holy shit, I didn't know I could be this efficient in my career. Like, I've literally never been a more efficient worker and more committed to being an earner too, like a breadwinner. It's just a big part of how I provide love for my family is like, moms want to make money too. And there's no shame in that at all.
No, I love it. A little break here for me to check in on your leadership development. Do you know what your individual leadership development needs are? Knowing what you need as a leader is the first step to becoming more confident and impactful in your leadership. I developed the Leadership Operating System Inventory for women like you. This holistic self-assessment allows you to assess your effectiveness in leading others, leading yourself, your ability to influence, your ability to manage your energy, and your communication skills. It's a way for you to quickly identify where you could focus your developmental resources. It will take you about 3 minutes for you to complete. If you think about it, that's a quick turnaround to gain insight into what would improve your effectiveness as a leader and make being a leader easier and more enjoyable. Get that insight by visiting womentakingthelead.com to take a fun, easy leadership inventory. That's womentakingthelead.com. Okay, so this can all feel very disheartening, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, creating that picture, but you have good news to share as well, because there are things that work.
Totally.
It's just not the individual approach.
Exactly. And I would say there's three pieces of action that I would challenge your listeners to take, three action items to take away from this. One happens at the individual level, so we can still take action individually, but do so in a way that is more of a collective approach. The second is at the organizational level in your company, in your organization, what can I do? And the third is at the legislative level, like what can I do when it comes to public policy? And the big common thread here is pay transparency. So to make that leap from equal pay to pay transparency, let me make this clear. We know when they've studied industries that have long had pay transparency at the, as a norm, like the GS scale, the government pay scale, the military has a very clear set of criteria for how you get paid and how your pay is determined, or even public education institutions mm-hmm. often have pay bands. Like those industries have the smallest gender wage gaps, because when pay is transparent, gender and racial wage gaps narrow. There are still differences in pay. That's why we're really talking about pay equity, not pay equality, mm-hmm. because differences in pay might be justifiable based on experience or scope of work or past education attainment. So there can be justifiable and legal reasons to pay people differently who are in similar roles. But pay equity means you're not explaining that pay disparity based on identity, like race, gender, and age. Because ageism, by the way, is a huge part of this. The gender wage gap explodes after women hit 40, which mm-hmm. is totally not fair and messed up. So shout out to all my women of a certain age who know what it's like to feel ageism and sexism combined in the workplace. So let me give you those three action items. As mm-hmm. an individual, the most powerful thing you can do to promote pay transparency and therefore narrow the gender wage gap is to talk about pay with your colleagues. It is your protected right. If you're an employee, you have the right to speak about your pay. And I'll give you a quick anecdote as to why this can be so powerful. A friend of mine, Colleen, works in publishing. And after some time pursuing her career, she was offered a promotion. And it just so happened that this was the very same promotion that a colleague of hers, who happened to be a man, had received just a few months earlier. Now, they have very similar backgrounds, similar years of experience, similar educational attainment. By all accounts, they were doing very similar work as editors at this company. And when she was offered the promotion, she was offered $5,000 more in pay. Now, anyone listening who's ever been offered a promotion might know that it's not like your employer rolls out the red carpet for you to negotiate, right? This mm-hmm. is a number that is told to you. This is not something that is asked of you, right? Mm-hmm.
But, and rarely are you asked, so what do you think about that?
Exactly.
Do you like that number?
Yeah, there's like no conversation. The presumption is you're welcome, be grateful, mm-hmm. right? So she got this promotion with 5K more, and she went to her male colleague and said, hey, just out of curiosity, would you be willing to share what your earnings are now that you've had this promotion? Because I'm being offered the same. Just want to make sure there's nothing, you know, different going on here. And he said, yeah, they gave me the promotion and gave me a $10,000 raise. You too, right? And her jaw almost hit the floor, right? In that moment, she had to decide, do I say something or do I say nothing? And because she is who she is, she went back to management and said, hey, thanks so much for the 5K. I think what would be more equitable would be a 10K raise. Don't you think that too? And because she was bold, because she dared to ask for more when she was not being asked what she thought of that, her mm-hmm. pay was adjusted. Mm-hmm. And I think that use of the word equitable was really clear there. That's an example of how pay transparency equips people to actually get more and actually ask for more, right?
Yeah. Yep. Because when we know what our colleagues who are doing similar work are making, it doesn't feel like such a big ask. Right. But when you have no concept of what other people are making around you, then you feel like you're asking for way too much.
Totally.
So it just like, it brings down those barriers.
Yeah. And it's hard to talk to people about money because we've been taught it's such a taboo. But that's a way that the working class has been held back forever. It's like, if we see each other as the enemy, then we'll never be transparent with one another. We actually have to see our peers not as competition, but as collaborators, as allies, and as people who are part of the same quest here, right? And so it takes courage to do that, but maybe it starts by sharing your salary first. Mm-hmm. Maybe it starts by asking, does this seem right to you? Here's what I'm being offered. Give me a gut check. Or maybe it's an over-under question. Would you be willing to tell me if you're making over or under 50K, because I want to know if I'm being lowballed here. Those are lots of creative ways to talk about salary, to overcome what Erin Lowry, I had her on my podcast a few months ago, talks about the life-changing magic of talking money with your colleagues, your friends, your family, and why it's so important to do so and overcome that taboo.
Yeah. And for, I think for a lot of people, it takes overcoming conditioning. So I love those examples you gave, because I grew up in an age and started working in an age where time after time, like whether it was a job offer or, you know, I was giving and being given an increase, it was always accompanied by the statement, and you are not to share this with anybody.
And that's
like
still
you
happens.
Were told that you could get fired if you shared your salary with other people. But you've already said earlier, and I want to reinforce, you have the right. It is the law that you can talk about your salary.
It's shocking, Jody, how many companies still have gag orders or these policies that say, we ask our employees not to share salary. And it doesn't matter, because you have a protected right. And the EEOC is there if you need to call them and find out more about your workplace rights. But this is a fundamental right that all workers have. If you're an employee, it's a little different if you're a contractor, but if you're an employee, you have the right to discuss your workplace conditions, including pay.
There's only one reason why you would be asked not to share your pay, because there are discrepancies.
Yeah. Well, it's shocking, because I'm always amazed at how companies see pay transparency as a threat. Because first of all, a lot of this has to presume unconscious bias, because I bet that Colleen's boss was not being malicious. Mm-hmm. They weren't saying, hey, I don't think women should earn equal pay, so I'm going to offer Colleen less than I offered her male colleague. Like, it's not that conscious. It's very unconscious. It's very historically based on what do we think Colleen needs to keep her here. And so it's not like there's an evil, malicious intent in management required for pay disparities between races and genders to exist. So if we presume good intentions, then the only companies who should feel threatened by pay transparency are the companies who literally profit based off of underpaying women and people of color. Mm-hmm. And that's like, that should be a warning sign if a company is showing any resistance to pay transparency, that they're betting on, they're profiting from unequal pay. Mm-hmm. So the last two things I'll say here is, approach your company collectively. That's the second step. If you're going to go to management and say, hey, have we ever done a pay equity audit? Has our HR department or compensation team, or if we don't have any of those things, has our founder ever thought about bringing in a pay equity auditor? Because those things exist. And that's someone who's going to help us classify the jobs, make sure that similar roles are paid similar amounts of monies, have similar ranges. We're going to commit to posting transparently on our open job descriptions, the pay ranges that are associated with each job. And we're also going to commit to, as a company, not asking folks in the interview process about their salary history or salary expectations. Can that, because that can also inadvertently perpetuate historic wage gaps between, you know, men and women or folks of color.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And, you know, asking for that, and if a company is open to it, even if there are disparities, like it's an act of goodwill.
Absolutely.
Right? There, like it exists, we see it, we want to clean it up.
Totally. And don't make this your hill to die on. Get some Chads and Brads behind you, right? Like join forces with your fellow colleagues, particularly white men, and say, look, we all believe in pay equity, young, old, you know, male, female, across the gender spectrum, across the racial spectrum. We collectively want to approach management together, because when you approach management as a collective, not only are you going to be more pervasive and persuasive and make this into not just a women's issue, because it really isn't a women's issue, it's a fairness issue, but that act of, let's say, all signing a letter and asking management to do a pay equity audit, or collectively approaching your boss in a meeting with five people behind you, that action is now protected. So if they retaliate against you, God forbid, if they start giving you bad assignments or taking you off the best client assignments, or maybe they demote you because you've been causing trouble lately, or they say anything to you about how you're being penalized for asking for something like a pay equity audit, if you do that collectively, you have protections. Mm-hmm. Again, under the rule of law, you can then frankly sue the pants off of your employer for retaliation. So go about this in a collective way, not just as a mindset, but in practical terms, because you're much more likely to be successful and protected.
Yes, I love this because what, you know, women do feel more comfortable and are very good at collaborating, right? Yeah. And when we make it less, I know there are some women out there too who are like, oh, it feels uncomfortable if it's about me. Right. But what if it's about everyone who's around me, right? The women, the men, all ages, like, what if it's about everybody? Like, we don't know who's getting paid what and who's experiencing the biggest gaps in this company. You know, it is about taking care of each other.
It's so much more socially acceptable for women to advocate for others than to advocate for ourselves. So let's use that to our advantage here, right? Like, be the captain of your squad, but it doesn't have to be all about you to be really powerful and frankly, for you to benefit from that collective action. And speaking of, that would be my third ask, would be to pay attention to what's happening in your state when it comes to pay transparency laws. Because yes, any organization can become committed to pay transparency as the norm, which is rapidly becoming a smart thing for businesses to do. But we don't have to wait for companies to just get on board, because a lot of states and cities are mandating those things that I just mentioned. I'm so proud to be here in Colorado because we were the first state in the nation back in 2019 to pass the Equal Pay for Equal Work Act, followed shortly thereafter by New York, California, and seven states and counting are even considering, have not only passed the legislation, but more states beyond the eight are considering the legislation in their state houses right now. And that legislation is so simple. It just starts with requiring job postings to list salary bands for every opening. And when that happens, I just sat down with Harvard Business School professor and researcher, economist Zoe Cullen, who studies the impact of pay transparency laws and mandates. When we pass these laws, when we pass pay transparency laws, we see gender and racial wage gaps narrow. We actually see worker engagement and motivation increase, Jody, because when I know what my boss makes, I'm going to feel more engaged and motivated because I have a realistic sense of my earnings potential at this company. And what I find really interesting for businesses is what they found is actually when companies have to set really clear and stringent pay bans, they're much more likely to negotiate aggressively. Because I can't just give you a raise, Jody, without giving everyone in your job class a raise. Mm-hmm. So what the impact is on the whole is that actually worker wages decline or wage growth declines overall. So companies who are smart and savvy about this are going to say, look, not only is it the right moral thing to do, but I can pay men and women equally. I can pay folks and sort of get to a more equitable pay philosophy as a compensation philosophy without ballooning my labor costs. This can actually be a really efficient move for companies who are watching the bottom line.
I really love this because I remember reading an article. I wish I could reference it, Emily. It's killing me right now. But it was talking about how the biggest societal changes, yes, started grassroots, but had legislation behind them to give them teeth.
Absolutely. Right? And right now, Congress, our U.S. Congress, is so fundamentally broken to the point where it's nearly useless. As a former political activist who used to work getting people elected to Congress and spent quite a few years early on working in politics at the federal level, I'm completely dismayed at Congress's inability to be a leader when it comes to legislating for our nation. But the flip side of that is that cities and states, city councils and state legislatures are carrying the mantle forward. So just like there's federal legislation that passed last summer or was enacted last summer called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which is not very widely understood, but it was a huge step forward for women's rights in the workplace. This is the first legislation that protected pregnant workers in terms of their rights from being fired or retaliated against, their rights to if you're a, let's say, a cashier at the grocery store, you have a right now to a stool to sit down. You have a right to take more breaks when you're pregnant. That kind of legislation passed on the federal level only after a majority of states had passed it in their state houses. So mm-hmm. I see pay transparency laws going in the same direction.
Yeah, needs that tipping point.
Absolutely. And so we have to pay attention to all that boring stuff that's happening in the state house. Like, it's so tedious to read that kind of local newspaper or find the podcast or listen to NPR, because those names of, frankly, like people you probably don't even know who represent you at the state house level, they have a lot more power than we give them credit for.
Absolutely. I think we've seen that over the last 8 to 12 years about how important these local governmental positions are. And when you get an idea of the kind of decisions that they're able to make, you suddenly get more interested in who's sitting in those seats. So yes, you've had several excellent calls to action for us. So Emily, tell us, where can everyone find you so they can follow you and hear about the things that you're excited about as well?
Thank you so much, Jody. This is obviously a passion of mine, and it's an evolving one. So I hope we can continue the conversation. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, search Bossed Up, BOSSEDUP, and find my podcast and subscribe. New episodes come out every Tuesday, and that's probably the best way to keep in touch with me. Otherwise, you can head to my website, bossedup.org, for our Take Action page, which talks all about systemic solutions, in addition to our programs and offerings and the latest and greatest of what I produce is there. So thank you for the opportunity, Jody.
Yeah, love that, Emily. And for those of you who are in the car, on the run, don't worry. All of those links will be in the show notes. They're in your app in the episode description, and they'll be on the Women Taking the Lead website on the show notes page. So you'll be able to easily click on any of the things that Emily just mentioned that had interest of you, and it'll take you right to her. And Emily, thank you so much for taking the time to inspire and enlighten us. We are all better for having met you.
Thank you so much, Jody. It's my pleasure.
Oh my gosh, she is amazing. And one thing I forgot to mention was that if you would like to hire Emily as a speaker, you can book her through her website, which is emilyaries.com. And she spells her name E-M-I-L-I-E. And Aries is A-R-I-E-S. So if you liked what she had to say and know she could be a powerful speaker for your organization or your event, definitely don't hesitate and scoop her up. And again, thank you so much for listening to the Women Taking the Lead podcast. I have three small favors to ask. If you are not yet subscribed to this podcast, hit the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss out on the upcoming episodes. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from this episode? Please share it with them. This episode is great for women and for allies. And if you are looking for leadership development opportunities for yourself, your team, or your organization, reach out to me. We can customize a program that meets your specific needs. You can reach me at jodi@womentakingthelead.com. It's J-O-D-I @womentakingthelead.com. And as always, I hope this was of value to you, and here's to your success.